in some departments almost took the view that the youth were probably never to want to spend his energy in a program outside of the department, in some ways indicated a lack of full commitment to the department. There were people that felt one should be committed to one's department. So one of the problems was to not have anybody suffer any penalties by going off and doing other things. And the hardest place to assure that that didn't happen was a promotion decision.
Could
you give an example of how one of the interdisciplinary programs was set up for that? Well, I forgot which was among the first that was formed. I think Asia Studies was one of the early ones to be put together. It happened to be that I've been in a little Far Eastern work, so I was kind of interested. I don't know. I can't think of anything specific now. Comes to mind how some of the ethnic studies programs began, because they kind of moved in on the same kind of machinery. Women's studies began the same way before the school broke up. I'm sorry, I can't remember in detail. I guess I was just aware that there were faculty that were interested in say, Latin American studies or in Asian studies, and that somehow one should work on a program to facilitate this. And I think they were among the earliest ones I worked with.
Okay. I want to hear about student unrest, too.
Well, I don't remember. I'd have to go back and look at the chronology of this. Well, the stuff began the last year McIntosh was here. What year was that?
69.
Yeah. Oh, me. Well, it seems to me that one of our first manifestations of student unrest was probably the Spader sculpture up there.
Which was in 68.
Yeah. That was under McIntosh, quite obviously. I was a member of the Academic Senate at that time. This didn't begin in our school, and so my relations with her remoted at second hand a little bit, because I knew Bob Tindall and he told me about some of the affairs and whatnot. Lots of stories about how that story began. You ought to talk to somebody that's in the middle of it. But apparently there was some tug of war over facilities and art. And the sculpture area felt it didn't have elbow room or something like that. And they began possibly thinking that they could attract, I don't know, some publicity or attention by perhaps approving some of these wild projects. I don't know. I've heard that as a story, but that probably isn't a valid story. But Spader was a master student, and he created a series of, they weren't sculptures, they were plaster. Metal frames with plaster of Paris, I guess, that's where they were made. And they consisted of stuff that a lot of people would have found fairly offensive. And the question was whether he could have a master show in a normal way, whether he had to have a master show. While this sculpture was being created, the janitorial and other people got upset about it. There were beginning to be rumors about some very naughty things were going on, bad things were going on. And I think when it came time for the master show, the dean backed away from having a master show the first time. And this led to a big agitation. Well, you shouldn't ask me this without my reviewing it, because I don't remember very much about it. Ultimately, the university reversed its position and decided to go ahead with the master show, and it was set up, and I went and saw it when it was set up, but it was never open to the public. It was intended to be, but I don't think it was ever open. I think in the interim, at one point, the sculpture had been locked up, and then somebody drove it into where it was locked up, and it was set up out on the lawn one morning. And the legislature got involved. The board of trustees got involved. President McIntosh's view was that, probably it was academic freedom to go ahead with the show, so he was supportive, and most of us tended to take the same view. And the Academic Senate. I think he was seriously damaged in his standing with the trustees by not taking a firmer stand and letting that thing become a matter of public controversy. Well, I think those are the things that I would like to comment on. I think more to comment on. But it led to some fairly large student demonstrations, and students became involved in significant scale in Japanese painter and sculpture. I've forgotten really the causes of some of the big student gatherings and marches on the administration. I was very much aware of them at the time, but I really don't recall a lot of them specifically. I sort of have to go back and review them and newspaper or something to comment on them intelligently. My office got involved when the ethnic studies aspect of it began to arise. We began to get the Black Student Association demanding a separate curriculum and a program in a department for Black Studies on campus. In various departments, there was sympathy with this point of view, and a lot of departments began to work on courses that would deal with Black history and various other things. And my first approach to the problem was to put together an interdisciplinary program which would be made up of these courses which the departments would create. And if we had followed that course, the logical result would have been that the departments would have hired minority faculty, would have developed this as a part of their total curriculum, but they'd have been integrated into the department and taught other things as well. Then an interdisciplinary program would have been put together, much as Asian studies or any of the other studies put together. We started out on that path, actually. I think the history that the documents I deposited over in the library sort of trace this history. Indeed, I think I wrote a history for President Horn of how things had got to where they were when he arrived as president.
Yeah, I haven't seen that. I will look diligently.
Yeah, I think there's something over there. If it isn't there, I must have it somewhere, because I put together a kind of chronological sequence explaining how each thing went. Well, this was not satisfactory to the Black Student Association. There were some confrontations in the Academic Senate, which they came in numbers, tried to overawe the Senate. Ultimately, they through demonstrations and other pressures got President McIntosh into a corner, apparently, where he felt that he would have to concede a Black Studies department. And so one afternoon he conceded it, and he said that the School of Letters and Science would be the home of the Black Studies department. And so he handed it to Ivan Cox and to me. And there we were. So now, instead of having an interdisciplinary program, we had a department. Well, for a department, you need faculty, and we got in the business of hiring faculty, and there weren't, I mean, several members of our faculty took the lead in the sense that they were willing to be an advisory committee, but very few of them were able to commit, were willing to commit their futures to a department, and none of them would have transferred. And all of them joined with the students saying, we've got to hire people into a Black Studies department. And the chaplain named Taylor in English was very strong in this one area. Well, I'll admit at first I didn't think much of the whole business. I even, when people brought me courses, I was going to offer a course in Black literature. My first reaction was, you know, literature is literature. Some literature is written by Blacks and some isn't. But if you're going to teach a course on the base, on who wrote it, well, that's a kind of an odd thing. I'll teach a course on it. Is there such a thing as Black literature? And so on. We got a lot of arguments. I was an integrationist. I didn't believe that, that anything good would happen except the sign of a segregation as a result of the Black Studies department. And I'm not so sure that, in fact, history hasn't proven that to be correct. I think the Black Studies classes are mainly filled with Black students and so on. I think they have a world of their own, which other people interact with only in a very minor way on campus, even though they've been here now for a long time. But I was finally persuaded by various people that maybe there was some validity to this proposition. And there were a lot of people who were writing on, a lot of literature was coming out. So I sat very much on the fence, one day feeling, oh, that's wrong, and one day feeling, well, maybe I'm just being prejudiced, maybe I just don't understand, maybe there is something, you know, that if I were a Black person, I would see differently. It was hard to cope with this. They would say, well, you're white, you can't understand this, you don't understand what we need. You'd be in a Dawson, you'll do it. We know what we need, you don't know what we need. Well, what gives you any right to set in judgment? It's been going on for, you know, hundreds of years. So that was the general approach. Well, eventually we got the business of hiring faculty and all the rest. Of course, the fiscal dean had to fund it, and the person who was then in the personnel office had to worry with all the hiring. And the students would put forward their own number and want them hired as faculty. And they put forward people they wanted hired as faculty activists and so on without academic training. So we got into real confrontations. And then they wrote an enormous curriculum. Exploitation of the Black athlete, soul food, you know, all the things that were going on all over, they were picked up and they wanted to offer them all on our campus. Well, that whole baggage of curriculum, of course, came onto my desk. And so we wrestled with that. Eventually, after arguing as long as we could, we accepted what we felt we had to accept, I guess, to keep from having revolution and confrontation, and said, oh, I can try to get this curriculum accepted. Well, it was my job, once we accepted it in the school, to get it accepted at other levels and all that. One of the questions was whether we were aiming at a degree in Black Studies or a certificate program in Black Studies, whether you'd be a history major with a secondary program in Black Studies or an anthropology major or a political science major. I felt very strongly that people should keep the academic major and have a secondary program in the ethnic studies. I didn't see that there'd be really a secure future for people with ethnic studies degrees that would be anything like their future if they had this kind of a dual program or a dual major almost. So I pushed very hard on that, drug my feet very hard on the major, and tried to get them, and I did get them to form a certificate program as an initial step to in Black Studies. But I admit, ultimately, we caved in under their pressure for curriculum. We caved in. You know, if you look at the catalogs, you'll see that there are all sorts of strange things in it. As I would view them, a lot has changed since.
that were put in there originally. But the year of confrontation was the last year McIntosh was on campus. And he passed this program over to us somewhere in the spring. And so the Black Student Association was now focused on our office. And I was the focus on curriculum. And the other fellows the focus on hiring. And Hayden was the focus in general. So we had to cope with this whole business and try to make the best of the situation. And we were still locked in controversy. The insistence of the Black Studies people was that they should be essentially free of all of the regulations of the white university and should have a parallel university of their own, small admittedly, but parallel, in which they would have their own rules. I kept on arguing that there was no way they could be on campus and a part of our university unless they came under at least the broad sense of rules, and so that they had to aspire to be ultimately a department if they wanted to be one in the normal sense. They might have special functions of community service because they were Black Studies, but basically, you know, they would be an academic program, too. And we were still sort of locking horns on who they would hire, how they would function, how much autonomy they would have. Great shouting matches and great meetings. As the academic semester came to an end into the summer, and that was the summer that President Horn came. And apparently, one of the things President Horn did was said to himself, well, there's the formal mechanism, which is the establishment on campus. There must be an underground as well. You know, all establishments have those who don't agree with the establishment. And he tried to establish contact. He had official contact with the establishment, which was more inevitable as he's coming in, but he also wanted to establish contact independently. Apparently part of his independent contact was to meet with the Black students and representatives of the Black community from town. And it was his decision then to bring in somebody who was known as Sleepy Montgomery, who was a basketball player, now calls himself Amun-Ra, and make him head of the Black Studies Department. Apparently, he thought that Amun-Ra would have the muscle and street know-how and would be wise in the ways of the ghetto, be able to confront the Black Student Association with a counter force. And that this was the thing that recommended him most. That he would have prestige because he was a basketball star. So he agreed to appoint him to make him head of the Black Studies Department, which was one of the points at issue, among others, which we were still negotiating with the BSN. Right over our heads, without any consultation with the school, to whom this department was assigned. This was one of the things that led Ivan Cox and Warren never to meet, you know, never fully to meet. And Hayden to ultimately resign. One of many issues, probably. This was one of the first. And I think he felt very embittered by this particular thing, because we'd spent a lot of blood, sweat, and tears working at the beginning, and so on. So there we were, not only we had a department, now we had a chairman that was appointed from the outside, so we've been blessed with a department and worried through all these other problems, and now we've arrived at the point where we have a chairman, too. And I'm afraid none of us were able really to conceal the fact that we weren't very happy with Mr. Montgomery. I mean, he sensed that, I'm sure. I remember one day he came into my office and said, "You've always been an enemy of mine," and so on. He shook his finger in my face and gave me a lecture. But it's true, I said he's not an academic person, we've done a terrible thing. We were holding out, ultimately, to make an academic department. We had to appoint people temporarily along the way, didn't have academic credentials, they would be temporary, and ultimately we'd find such people. And particularly, we'd find somebody to head the program with academic credentials. So we weren't very happy. So that was the ethnic studies. That wasn't the end of the, I think we had further confrontations, but it seems to me that was the year in which most of the ruckus was going on. But I laid it all out, there's a whole set of documents, all the stories, except maybe the story of hiring him. Mr. Montgomery was chairman. He, by the way, had a BA degree in physical education. I believe, B.S., B.A. The time he was hired to be chairman of the department, well, it was hard for my coordinator to make much progress. He worked, I will say, in many ways, and, you know, he ultimately came around to see that perhaps, you know, he'd have to hire academic people and so on, so maybe in the last analysis it was possible that something would happen. Came up to what he calls advanced faculty. We tried to make the best of it, of course. Matter was further complicated. There were two deaths in the office, in the associate dean's office, when I was over there. First of them was Sam Wiley, who died, and then was replaced by Jack Allen from Political Science and Personnel. And I think most of this Black Studies confrontation blew up when Jack Allen was Personnel man, so he did the first worrying about that. Then he died, and there was hired in that office someone named Robinson. He was a Black and from Stanford with a degree in higher education, or at least he was in the process of getting a degree. And I had gotten on very well with everybody else, but I couldn't get on with Swim Robinson. He and I just never got on. So the problem of dealing with ethnic studies was made more complex because instead of having a sort of cohesive office, we now had people pulling in opposite directions. He felt that he should have charge, really, of the ethnic studies programs, and I said, on the curriculum side of it, and other things are in my daily life, I'm not going to turn loose, and that's why we probably didn't get along. So, that added another dimension of complexity in the whole picture. Well, having conceded ethnic studies, principal of departments to the Black Studies Department, the question was whether or not we stop at that point, or when we go on to the other ethnic areas. They, of course, organized under the Third World Movement. The Chicano movement was fairly active. The Chicanos had begun during the same year the Black Studies had begun, and I think we even had the Third World Movement that same year. And so there were the Asian students. There was one chap who came in, who was a sort of a tall, blonde, ruddy person with blue eyes, and said he wanted to form the American Indian Studies program. And I remember saying, I wonder whether you're a qualified Indian, but I didn't ask him that. But we had all these things start up now. I had forgotten how far any of that got that first year. But my position was, well, the foot's in the door, there's not much we can do. We can't say to Chicanos, you can't have a department. all we can do is try to work with them so that they get off to a somewhat better and less tempestuous start than the Black Studies people did. So I worked with the Mexican American Studies group, and my relations with them were very good, partly because they sensed that I wasn't trying to. I told them frankly, you know, we want to put it together well. And I'm not against the principle. The principle's been conceded. You don't have to batter me on the principle. But I do have some feelings about how we're going, and I want to understand what they're doing. So I read a lot on it. Well, I developed a pretty good relationship with them. I even wrote a little article for them in one of our seminars, which they offered for them. How you establish ethnic studies departments, and I have that manuscript, that article. So, we also had the business end of hiring faculty, and the faculty problem was even worse in some ways there among the blacks, because there would be even fewer Chicanos that was probably going along well in the educational line. They were more willing, I think, to concede that people should have academic credentials. A little less of the confrontation, a little less of the demand to be completely autonomous. Some of that was not as strong, at least the leaders we have. So, I worked to help them develop a parallel program. And then the Asian American students were another problem that I didn't expect to arise. In that particular case, I think we were fortunate. We had a faculty member in political science who didn't complete his degree and was let out. But whom I concluded after many long talks with him, because he became advisor to the Asian American students, would be really a good person. And who gave me a lot of insight into the whole ethnic studies problem, which I really was hard time getting from other people. That was Lloyd Inouye, who I happen to be very fond of as a person. So we encouraged him to form a interdisciplinary program, which is all that. It never became a department. It's an interdisciplinary program. Then somebody pointed out that the Indians really were a very abused and downtrodden group, and we want to do something for them, which I'm perfectly happy to do, having now committed myself. So we searched high and low to find somebody that would take charge of an Indian program. And I don't know how we came on so many names. Oh, Tom and Robot, I've forgotten how she came to our attention. But her background was in nursing, and so on. And she helped start up a small program in Indian studies. We went out and hired somebody else whose name I forget and died within a year of coming here. And subsequently went on to Richard Band, who was the president and chairman of the program. But in these two cases, they've remained sort of programs and not become full-scale departments. And they never aspired to get degrees. But Mexican-American Studies and Black Studies both aspire to have degrees, which I admit I advised them against getting involved in, but they wouldn't accept my advice on that. I became the vehicle for giving birth to ethnic studies. If you ask me today whether I was ever fully converted to whether or not that was the right thing to do, I'd have a hard time answering that question. Some days I felt I was, and some days I felt I don't believe in it. I think perhaps I'm being the instrument of disservice to the minorities. And we're going to create ghetto programs that are not going to be as strong academically, and the training that people receive may be deficient, simply because the faculty are not there, or because the departments won't seek for and hire faculty, or having got off to starts with chairman like Sleepy Montgomery, it's pretty hard for them to attract people with the strong academic credentials, you know. So here we are, we're going to they're going to create an isolated program. The faculty are going to be isolated. They're not going to be integrated into the university as fully as they would be if they were hiring departments. So what have I done? What, you know, have I done a good thing or a bad thing? I really don't know the answer to that. One of the problems that I was convinced of along the way by Lloyd and Julie and Lutan and Roebuck and others was that minority student feels very, very lonesome on a campus like this. That to have a home and to have somebody who's a champion, to have a shelter for a period of time is essential to retention of these students on campus. To get them launched. That I very much accepted. But at what point they are launched and then enter into the university? I think somewhere in the 4 years they should be in the mainstream of the university. They should no longer be ghettoized and were programmed as their own too much. That their labor, that their courses they take, or the major they take, or whatever they do should be somewhat limited in school. Basically, they should have an academic major so they can go out and say, I am a history major like any other history major. I also happen to be trained in ethnic studies. Now I've got both, and I'm the old argument is you're asking us to do things you don't ask other people to do. I said, I have to ask you to do that, or you're not going to be able to function to do the job you want to do for your community.
Yeah, that brings up a question. You were just involved with the curriculum, or were you involved with other things? Because it seems to me that maybe the most important part of creating a secure place is providing support services, tutoring and things like that to help them adjust to the university situation.
Yeah.
But you were just involved in setting up the curriculum?
No, I also worked with the EOP office, the first people I came on in that program. We tried to set up a special first-year program for EOP students. Trying to set up various pre-college programs that would take in people whose background was perhaps not adequately strong. And I tried to identify faculty on campus that were particularly sympathetic to this project and create special sections in which these students would be focused, where the faculty had pledged themselves to work with these students. So I worked very closely with the EOP office to try to create. We created some special courses for EOP students, special courses in language skills. And for a while we hired people out of our office to teach those and be funded some of those courses. The EOP didn't have money for faculty. I helped set up a tutoring center for them, or tried to, in the library. I think they functioned there for a time, and now it's a media area, and that's been reconverted. So, of course, Alan Michio was second or third. I think he was the third person to hold that EOP appointment. He was the person that's in the job now. And I knew both of the other two people. And I ran interference through a lot of committees, councils, and so on, for some of these programs, and boy, I know a lot of abuse for it, too. People say, you don't really believe in that, do you? But it was my job, and once we made a commitment to the program, I tried to put down my doubts as they arose, and my worries about where we were going. Somebody had a fight to get the programs accepted, to get the courses accepted, and get involved in the GE, and this meant going to the PEP Council and getting them approved for general education, and because we ran into a lot of static in a lot of areas that people didn't want to accept it. So, the same is true of the special language skills programs. People say, well, you're creating really courses that are below the college level, you shouldn't be giving college credit for them. But the students that came here had to have a certain number of units to qualify and stay in school, so we couldn't create non-credit courses. And the parents of the minority students wanted to get them through college as quickly as possible, and they didn't want them to have a half a year or a year before they really were college students. They wanted them to, you know, they said, what are you up to? Why don't you give them credit for this? Give them credit for all sorts of other things around here. So there was a lot of controversy over that. I did create some special courses. That was done out of my office. Language skills was one of them. I also worked with the program and helped fund the program. It was developed for foreign students, special language program. None of these things were easy to do because they were expensive. They really had to be subsidized out of the budget of the school. In the early years, we had some money to do these things. As the budget began shrinking, it became increasingly hard to do that. We really tried to work out a kind of a initial year program for the early EOP students, in which they would take kind of a standard curriculum, which would emphasize the learning skills particularly that they needed to succeed in the university. So that went through a whole lot of vicissitudes, and that's another place where Robinson, you know, thought that he should have a major say. I felt I knew what I was doing at the university. I've been doing it for a year or so before he arrived, and I jolly well continue. And I didn't see a reason to turn over my educational responsibilities to him. Well, we didn't get along very well. That's why I didn't keep him when I became dean. I just didn't feel I could work with him. Not many people in the world I feel that way about, but somehow we just didn't get along. Well, that's what happened in ethnic studies. So there are an awful lot of people you would ask around here, and they'd say, Wilby is the one that gave us that, all that junk we got on campus. They would blame me for it, because I ran interference for it.
Yeah, could you talk about your circumstances
that led to McIntosh's departure? Well, there was an anti-McIntosh movement on campus. I wasn't a part of that. For two reasons, I was not an administrator. And secondly, I really feel I quarreled with him. We fought hard, going to the mat on issues. I still had a lot of respect for him. I felt he was a pretty good man. I still do. So I didn't feel I wanted to be a part of any organization that was designed to prove that he should go. So I never was very close to that organization. I don't know very much about that. But I'm sure there were people that worked behind the scenes to get rid of it. But I can't tell you much about that. I think the Spader affair and various other things probably led to his feeling that he was losing support in the trustees. I don't know whether he was told that he should resign or whether he resigned. I really don't. I'm not sure I knew it well enough so he would have told me that. We had some drinks together and so on, and he was leaving one time at some function that we both met at. What he told me was that he saw things going from bad to worse, and that he felt he had enough. He was just tired of administration and went out. And you can get to feel that way. I felt that way after 3 years of being interim dean of letters and science. I didn't want to be part of administration for quite a while. I was talked into putting my name into the associate vice president's job and so on. But for a long time, I was just tired. You can get that way. You just feel it's a very tense thing. You can't make any mistake. There are so many things you have to consider. And yet, you can't just back away from every principle and thing you believe in. So how do you stand for the things you think are important and you believe in, and still not provoke that bitter controversy that when people never forgive you and they continue to work year in and year out for your undoing because they hate your guts? That could happen very easily. It's hard to take that kind of hatred, particularly when sometimes, you know, it happens with people that you've known for a long time. You cross them on something, you disagree with them or something. Up to a certain point, you know, friendships will let them disagree and people will respect you and all this, but at some point people become bitter. And particularly people that don't know you well, you make decisions about their lives, their promotions, or this or that or another, and they become very bitter. And people that I'm sure hate me and think I'm a terrible man because I didn't promote them, for example. Or as I didn't agree to endorse their promotion. And I've gone into fights on that principle on hiring in departments, where I thought departments had not made adequate searches when they would then pass resolutions denouncing the excessive interference of the dean in their departmental affairs. It's easy to write a memo that maybe is a word a little wrong, somebody takes it wrong. You know, you're always on the ragged edge. There's a real tension that's involved in that. Maybe it gets you tired after a while. Dr. McIntosh felt very much harassed. So whether he was asked to resign or whether he resigned, you know, on his own, I don't know. But I can well understand the emergency felt he had enough.
Was there anything else except the state or thing that precipitated anything?
Well, there was this running fight. There was the Metzger affair and the O'Gare affair, and that made enemies that were bitter and never forgave him. There was the reorganization of the college where people appealed over his head to the trustee's office virtually and forced him to do things he didn't want to do. There may have been little things like publishing documents he didn't approve of and in effect making them operative. There was a defeat over his building, which he took very much amiss. There's lots of things. And I think he had less and less contact with a friendly sort of faculty. He felt more and more isolated. But I really don't know. I mean, I can't claim to know him well enough to know why. He made, I know he recorded the interviews for the project, I think Asher made interview. He may have set down his reasons, you know, fully at that point. I don't really know.
Okay, I have one more question about the history department before I set you off. Could you describe the circumstances under which Camp Applegate came?
In which you joined the faculty? No, I think he began teaching part-time. People got to know him. And then he retired to City College. And I wasn't in the department at the time that the decision was made to hire him, I don't believe. So I'm not the party to how they came to that decision. And ultimately it became a matter of some controversy, I guess. Particularly until becoming chairman then. One of the few departments I quarreled with was the associate dean was the history department.
How come?
So, the staff they had doing their scheduling, the departments would use people for scheduling coordinators, and sometimes called them assistant chairman. There were two of them, one in sociology and one in history, with whom I couldn't negotiate. It seemed in good faith, that is to say, we couldn't come to agreements, but they then would carry out. One of them was in history and one of them was in sociology. One of them was an avid union man. I remember saying to him, look, goddammit, when you finish negotiating, you go down there and sell the contract. Don't you go down there and rouse the troops against the very contract you negotiated with me yesterday, or you can go to hell. Well, that was the sociology department. That wasn't history. But they were, I had trouble somehow coming to understanding the job. That was one thing. I don't really understand Applegate. He was a man of few words, and I never developed any rapport with him. I didn't think he was a very strong, effective chairman of the party. Then we had a big quarrel over